name is Bea Hardy, and I am interim dean of university libraries. I'm also normally director of special collections, which is right in here, which is where the university houses its manuscripts, university archives, and rare books. And that's also the source for most of the exhibits you see in SWEM Library. We do have exhibit cases on this floor, second floor, and third floor. The third floor right now, by the way, is a student-created exhibit on tobacco and the college that a class created. So you might want to go take a look at that. They did a very nice job. My personal favorite is the ashtray that plays the alma mater. But there's some neat things in that. The particular exhibit that you're looking at, Bibles at SWEM Library, came about actually from outreach to an English class on Bibles. And the class had 180 students, so it was too big to bring over here. We don't have any classroom space large enough for that. So I did do a PowerPoint and took some Bibles over to Tucker Hall to the classroom. And then when we were looking for an exhibit to do, we used that as a starting point. This actually is considerably more than what I did for that class. So feel free at any point to stop me, ask questions, and so on. Okay. This is the first case in the exhibit. We'll circle around the rotunda and then go into special collections. Ideally, we would have the cases very nicely organized left to right and top to bottom, but it doesn't work out that way. The cases are kind of an odd size. Some of the Bibles are very large and wouldn't quite open or fit into that space, but would fit here, and so on. So we jump around some, for which I apologize. And so we will start, in fact, at the bottom of this case. Okay, and that would be with the first printed Bible, that by Gutenberg in the 1450s. This is a facsimile, by the way, not an original Gutenberg. And one of the things I want to point out is, as with any new technology, and we're much more comfortable with new technology than people used to be. And we're much more used to change. But new technology was often viewed with some suspicion. And so anything you can do to allay people's concerns was something you wanted to do. And Gutenberg, as a printer, decided one thing he needed to do was to make people comfortable and realize this could be just as beautiful as the manuscripts that the monks were producing. And so he created the type. Okay, and you'll notice the other thing we have on the bottom here is this tiny little book. It's a Dutch book of hours. It's a medieval layperson's book of prayers and other religious texts. It is a manuscript book. Okay, that's written by hand. Okay, you'll notice the type that Gutenberg created, the movable type, looks just like that handwriting. Okay. And that was deliberate. That was a way of making it seem less threatening. Okay. Gutenberg's Bible took a long time to produce. Okay. It was much cheaper than a monk's handwritten copy would be. Okay. It would only take 3 years' wages for the average person. In other words, the average person wasn't buying Gutenberg's Bible. It was mostly institutions, monasteries, and so on, that bought Gutenberg's Bibles. There were about 180 copies that he produced by 1455, and of those, 47 or 48 survive, which is a remarkable percentage when you consider that's more than 550 years ago. And so his was the first very laborious to produce, but something that other printers quickly started to emulate. And so we hop up here to the top left, okay, to a much more entrepreneurial printer than Gutenberg, and that's Anton Koberger. Okay, Koberger, like Gutenberg, was German. Okay, but if you're familiar with business terms, he was into vertical integration. Okay, and so he controlled paper production. You know, he had his own paper mill, so to speak. He had printing presses in various towns in Europe, and he had a whole network of retail outlets in cities throughout Europe. In fact, at his biggest printing establishment, there were more than 100 people employed, okay, which for the early 1480s, and this particular edition is 1483, that was really big business. Okay? An establishment with 100 employees was huge. And that actually, we only have a few pages. We have a fragment of one of his Bibles. It is in German. The Gutenberg is in Latin. Gutenberg's is the Latin Vulgate edition. Koberger's is the 9th German Bible printed. Okay. And it is actually a full copy of it. It has very lavish illustrations. Our section of it does not have much in the way of lavish illustration, but nonetheless, you get the idea. Okay. And up here on the top right, we have a leaf from another Bible. Okay. And this is the first of our Bibles that is scholarly. Okay. This was, it's called the Complutensian Bible. It was created by a scholarly research group brought together in Spain by a cardinal. He paid for it out of his own pocket, not out of the church's money. And they worked for more than a decade, okay, trying to get as close to the original as possible, using different versions, different languages of the Bible, and printed them in parallel columns. So there's actually parallel columns up top, and then there's additional parallel columns on the bottom of different languages, Greek, Aramaic, Latin, and so on, comparing that. So that was the first polyglot Bible, as it was called, the multi-language Bibles. Okay, and then we end here with the middle, the two Bibles, sets of Bibles here in the middle. The one here on the right, I want to point out a couple of things. First of all, this is the earliest of our Bibles with markings, with handwritten markings, where people underlined or made comments in the margin and so on. And I'm particularly taken, you see their little fingers pointing at things in the text. He drew fingers in the margin to point out text. And so we opened it to this page because of the little fingers. But in fact, this is a very lavishly illustrated Bible. And the artist is quite famous. His name was Hans Holbein. He created in the 1520s more than 90 woodcuts of Bible scenes. And he was another German. The Germans were among the leading printers and engravers and so on. So he was another of these Germans. But he had painted Erasmus, the great Dutch humanist. Okay? And then he went to England, where Erasmus put him in contact with Sir Thomas More, who moved in the same humanist circles. And so his first trip to England, he was there for a few years. More was his patron. And then he went back to the continent for a visit, and by the time he came back, More was out of favor, of course, eventually would be executed. And so he quickly, you know, he was quite adaptable, so found new patrons. Sir Thomas Cromwell and Anne Boleyn. Of course, they both also ended up being executed. Not to worry, our man Hans found another patron and became the great portrait painter of Henry VIII's court. And so the portraits, if you have any mental image when you think of Henry VIII, it is probably Hans Holbein's portrait of him, and the same of the courtiers. It would be Hans Holbein's portraits. And so he did do all these images. We don't have it open to that because we're open to the pages with markings, but we did reproduce some of the images around here so you could see that. So illustrated, one way of going. Okay. This on the left is another approach. Okay. And you'll see the print is teeny tiny. Okay. It is, okay, you all have young eyes. Okay. So you probably could read that. Okay. I could only read that even with my glasses on if I smudged my nose with the ink. Okay. Then think about reading it by candlelight. Okay. It's not a pretty picture, but they were very determined. Okay. This particular edition, this is a two-volume edition. The part on the left is in its original binding. This particular two-volume set is from 1545. It was printed by a Paris printer named Robert Estienne, or Robert Stefani. Okay. He had started life Catholic and became Protestant. Okay. And he was a very scholarly type. And so he had started collecting as many early manuscript versions of the Bible as he could find, okay, trying to get back as close to the original as possible to make the most accurate version he could. And so he started producing a lot of commentary. Okay. He would have annotations and, you know, give the source which early version was supplying this particular wording, and so on. And, you know, alternate translations, and all that sort of scholarly paraphernalia. Of course, one of the key things was, if you look at Gutenberg's Bible, no chapters. Yes, it's divided into books, but no chapters, okay, and no verses. Okay. So when you start doing all of this little scholarly paraphernalia, how do you tell people what you're referring to? And so Robert Estienne was the one who came up with the chapter and verse system. Okay. And so he's a very important guy. He actually was hounded out of Paris 5 years after printing this particular Bible, and headed for Geneva. Of which, more later. That's it for this case. And so we'll move on to case number two. Okay. And in this case, I want to start with the left side of the case. Okay. Starting with the little Bible here on the left, and then these two Bibles in the middle and the top. Those are all editions by the same guy. And I know I'm pronouncing his name wrong because I'm terrible at French, but Théodore de Bézi was the man's name. He was a theologian. He succeeded John Calvin as professor of theology in Geneva, and he was very Calvinist in his approach to theology. He did provide a polyglot Bible, and so it's Latin and Greek. It's the Vulgate Latin, Greek version, and then his own translation into Latin. Okay. And some margin notes and very Calvinist commentary on the Bible. As I say, we do have these three editions. His first edition came out in 1560. Our little edition here was 1580. And by the way, you can also consider the size matters. A little Bible like that, yeah, you can hold that in your lap. Gutenberg, you're not holding in your lap. Okay, that's meant for a pulpit or a big desk or something like that. So these are more personal Bibles. The smaller ones are more personal Bibles intended for individual use. And so that's this 1581. And then we've got some others here that can go either way. The 1589 up here and the 1598. But I do want to point out the 1589 and the 1598 both have William and Mary connections. Okay. The top one belonged to William Webb. We have a copy of the book plate there. Webb was a member of William and Mary's class of 46, 1746. The bottom one, the middle one here, belonged to William Yeats. Yeats was a member of the class of 1744, and he was president of the college in the early 1760s. And these came to us later. Okay, the college library burned several times, most recently in the Civil War. And so these books did come to us after the Civil War, or else they would have been burned to a crisp like everything else. We actually only have one book from the college library before the Civil War, and that was one that was stolen by a Yankee soldier during the war, before the fire, and he returned it later. So that's our only one. So Theodore de Beze, Calvinist, and very, very scholarly edition there. Okay. Also on the bottom here in the middle is another scholar's translation. And he did translate into Latin. And so this is a post-Vulgate Latin edition. And the Vulgate Bible, as you don't know, was translated by St. Jerome in the 400s. And so this is by Emmanuel Tremelius, who was a Jewish convert to Christianity, translated this particular version. And he floated around some. He was at Cambridge University as professor of Hebrew for a while, and then he went back to the continent and was there. This particular one he published initially in the 1570s. Our version is 1593. Okay. And then up here is the Osiander Bible. The Osiander's grandfather, father, and son were all professors of theology. Okay. And unlike Tremelius, who undertook an entirely new Latin translation, what they did was to correct the Vulgate. And you can see Andreas Osiander up there. His image was included in the introduction to the book. Okay, so that's a new Latin translation. Okay, and let's see. Who else do we have? On the right, we didn't open it largely because it was awkward to open, is the earliest Italian Bible. That was translated by Diodati in 1605, was first published. Our edition is the 1641 edition. Okay. And then here in the middle right, we have two Bibles that I want to point out. The one on the right is another William and Mary connection. It's a 1675 Greek New Testament, but it has a book plate for Emmanuel Jones. While he was at the College of William and Mary, he was not only an alumnus of the college, but if you've heard of the Brafferton School, which was the Indian school on campus where the Brafferton building is, he was the schoolmaster there for almost 20 years. And so it is a Greek New Testament, very scholarly one. Okay. And in the middle there of the middle shelf is another polyglot Bible from 1684. But this one was published in Amsterdam, and this was kind of the heyday, or just past the heyday, of Dutch influence in culture. And so Dutch is one of the languages. It's Dutch, French, and English in terms of the languages. Unlike these other ones, they were kind of scholarly of the Greek and two versions of Latin and so on. This was in all vernacular languages. Okay. And finally, down here is our Harry Potter Bible, which you come close, you can see it's got the clasps and it's, you know, this big heavy thing. It is a Lutheran Bible from 1707. Several pages in from the title page, there's a page that's reproduced back there that has the various members of Luther's family on it. Okay. And I also want to point out it was dedicated to... one of the German electors who went on to become, in addition to being elector of a province in Germany and was Lutheran, he also became king of Poland and had to become Catholic to become king of Poland. But he did allow his province in Germany to remain Lutheran. So it was kind of a split identity for him, but he did let the province remain Lutheran. Which was not always a guaranteed thing. I mean, we're used to having freedom of religion ourselves, and it wouldn't occur to us just because, you know, the head of the country is one religion that everyone's got to be that. But that was the case frequently then. So we'll move on. Do y'all have any questions? Okay. Now we get to English versions of the Bible. Okay. And the first translation of the Bible was into English was by Wycliffe, and that was while it was still a manuscript Bible before Gutenberg had invented print. Those were copied by monks and others by hand. Okay? And we don't have any copies of that at SWEM. There are about 250 fragments of Wycliffe Bibles left. So there were quite a lot of them in existence at one point. But on the top left here is an example of the text from that Bible. And as I say, that was in the 1380s. Okay. The printed version of the English Bible really starts with William Tyndale. Okay. And we do have a Tyndale Bible here. It's on the middle shelf on the left. It's displayed closed because it is in bad shape, and you can see it's tied with the red tape. That's from 1550. That is 14 years after Tyndale was killed. But he had been a scholar in England. In the 1520s, England was still Catholic, and he applied to the English Catholic authorities for permission to translate the Bible from the original Greek and Aramaic. Okay. I guess it was a Hebrew text that he had, not the Aramaic, but Hebrew text, rather than using the Latin Vulgate to translate into English. Okay. They were very suspicious of him, and so they refused. He did leave England, went to Holland, and began translating the Bible. He translated the New Testament first and had that published, smuggled into England. The authorities burned most copies of that. And their worst fears, by the way, were confirmed by the way he was translating things. Because instead of translating church as church, he was translating it as congregation. Instead of priest, would use senior or elder or so on. And these were all kind of code words, as far as they were concerned, for Protestant and heretic. Okay. And so, meanwhile, he was translating the Old Testament. Okay. And he was in Holland at the time, which was known for being fairly tolerant. However, Holland was also trying to get the favor of England for international reasons. And so as a diplomatic favor to England, to try to get their help, they executed William Tyndale in 1536. Tyndale's influence was huge. A 1998 study showed that in the King James Version, 84% of the New Testament and 75% of the parts of the Old Testament that Tyndale had translated. He didn't get through the whole Old Testament before he was executed. But so 84% and 75% were directly from Tyndale of the King James Version. And so he did have a long-lasting influence, his translation did. And in fact, a mere year after his execution, King Henry VIII had taken England out of the Catholic Church and created the Church of England and ordered, yes, a new translation of the Bible into English for the Church of England. The English government hired, or the church hired, one of Tyndale's chief assistants, Miles Coverdale, to make that translation. And there were a couple of interim steps, but Coverdale and another man had produced what was called the Great Bible, first edition, 1539. We do have a Great Bible here, and these were meant for the churches. They were meant for the pulpits and so on, so they are bigger, bigger editions. So this on the bottom right is our Great Bible. The first printing, 1539, Queen Elizabeth later ordered additional printings in 1562 and 1566. So ours is the 1566 edition. And if you do come up here later, you'll see, and it's open to the first page of the New Testament, Queen Elizabeth is on there. She's sitting on the bottom of that diagram. Miles Coverdale, of course, did use a great deal of Tyndale's version. Coverdale was not nearly the scholar that Tyndale was. He didn't know Greek and Hebrew very well. He did know Latin, so he did use the Latin Vulgate for some of this. Queen Elizabeth also ordered not only the printing of the second and third editions of the Great Bible, but she also ordered that the Bible be translated into Welsh, Wales being part of her kingdom. And we do have the first edition of the Welsh New Testament, which was printed in 1567, and that's what's here on the middle shelf, on the left that's open. It's in horrible shape, as you can see. So we were able to fully open it because, hey, the binding's gone, as you can mostly see. But so you can see what the original Welsh looked like. Okay. And then we've got here on the right side, the upper and middle shelf, copies of what's called the Geneva Bible or the Breeches Bible. Between King Henry VIII and Queen Elizabeth, there was another queen, Queen Mary, a.k.a. Bloody Mary, who persecuted the Protestants. She was very Catholic, and she did persecute the Protestants. Many Protestant ministers and theologians from England fled during the 1550s while Queen Mary was on the throne, and most of them fled to Geneva, where there was a very strong Protestant tradition with John Calvin and Theodore de Beze, Robert Estienne of the chapter and verses over in the first case. They had all ended up in Geneva. And so our English theologians ended up in Geneva as well. and began translating the Bible. Okay. And that work was directed by an Englishman named William Whittingham, who happened to be, by the way, John Calvin's brother-in-law. And so they did produce this translation of the Bible in 1560. It was the first edition that came out. It was a very scholarly edition. It was full of Calvinist commentary. And the margin notes and so on. You can see some of that in the tiny text up on the one that's open on the top shelf. You can also tell from the size it was meant for personal use. Okay, this was the Bible of the English people. As one scholar called it, the family Bible of the English people. This was the Bible used by the colonists who came to America. For the most part. Not the King James Bible. The Breeches Bible was the one. It went through 140 editions, from at least 140 editions, 140 that we know of, from 1560 to 1644. And it was called the Breeches Bible, by the way, because in the part of Genesis where it's describing Adam and Eve figuring out that they're naked and they make clothes for themselves, it says they made breeches for themselves. So we have a little copy of that page and a red arrow to it on the sidewall there. Okay. The other thing I want to point out about this Bible is, as you can see, we have something that says Rolfe Family Bible 1580 and the Rolfe Family Coat of Arms. That is the book plate in this particular Bible. It's, again, in very rough shape. And you can see, by the way, how the books were bound, given that the cover is mostly off of it. But this was the family Bible of John Rolfe, who, of course, married Pocahontas. And she did become a Christian before their wedding. So it could very well be the Bible that Pocahontas used. Okay. And then finally we get to the lower left, okay, and we do have here on the wall is a leaf from the first edition of the King James Bible in 1611, and this bound volume on the floor of the case is a kind of hybrid. The New Testament is 1611. The Old Testament is 1613. Okay? And what had happened was when King James came to the throne after Queen Elizabeth's death in 1603, he did call a conference of both Puritans and Anglicans. And the Puritans did still consider themselves Anglicans, but just as shorthand, Puritans and Anglicans. Those who more favored a hierarchical church and those who didn't. The Puritans felt that the Bible that the Church of England was using in the pulpit and the Great Bible had been superseded by the Bishop's Bible. And you can know Bishop's Bible. Puritans didn't go for the bishops. So they didn't care. We don't have a Bishop's Bible, by the way, which is why it's not on display. But anyway, they didn't care for the Bishop's Bible. And so they're trying to find something that the two sides could agree on. And so James did appoint groups of scholars, six groups of scholars, to each in Oxford, Cambridge, and Westminster to create a new translation of the Bible, hoping to find one that all sides could unite around. And the result was known as the King James Bible. Okay. Initially, the only one with the right to print the Bible was the king's printer, Robert Barker. He figured it would be a big seller, and so he did commission other printers around London to do some of the work. And so actually, pretty much every Bible that's considered a first edition King James, including ours, is a little bit of a hybrid, because there are different printers who did different parts of it. you know, different printers who would each do, you know, the first, you know, the Gospels or whatever. And so they're all a little bit different from each other. Barker also kept, by the way, horrible financial records. And so there were lawsuits for many years, for several decades, in fact, back and forth over money owed and so on for the printing of the King James Bible. Eventually, of course, it did become the big bestseller and pushed the Breeches Bible out of the way. But it did take several decades and Archbishop Laud banning the Breeches Bible to make King James the big seller. Okay. And then here in the final case in the Rotunda area, we have more English Bibles on display. And I want to start first on the upper left, not a complete Bible, but a Psalter, the King James Psalter from 1637. King James did fancy himself something of a scholar, and so officially he's credited with that. In fact, it was actually a real scholar who did the work, and James claimed the credit, and it was published after his death. Okay. And then I mentioned back with the King James Bible that the only one who had the right to print that was the king's printer. That was because it was crown copyright. Okay. Eventually, in 1629, both Oxford University Press and Cambridge University Press, and I understand you guys are freshmen, you will be buying many Oxford and Cambridge Press books probably over the course of your college career. But anyway, they did exist back in the early 1600s, and they sued in court and won the right to print the King James Bible. And so it was only those three presses, the King's printers, Oxford and Cambridge, that could print editions of the Bible. And so that's all of the Bibles in here are from those presses. In the middle here, we have first a 1658 Bible, just a little one. And I wanted to show you that in particular because it's got a little foredge painting. This is the foredge of the book. And in not so much the 1600s, but the late 1700s, early 1800s, painting them became a real art. And in most of them, you can't see when the book is just closed that there's a painting there. You have to kind of fan it out, and then you can see the painting. It's incredibly detailed, delicate work. And Swem Library has one of the largest collections in the world of foredge painting books. This happens to be a very early version of a foredge painting, but it's one you can see without having to fan the book. And by the way, we have, I think, about 24 foredge painting books that the foredge painting is pornographic, and almost all of those are on Bibles or books of common prayer, for whatever contrary little reason. Oh, yes, dear, I'm reading the Bible, don't worry. So there's a foredge painting from 1658. Okay, and then on the right middle shelf, all three of these books are 1660 Bibles from John Fields and Henry Hills. And it was a difficult time to be a printer in England. Okay. This was a very topsy-turvy time politically. The Puritans, as you may know, did take over in England. They killed King Charles I. And there was a Puritan Commonwealth for some years. In 1660, the Stuart family was restored to the throne with Charles II. And so in this middle one, you'll see by Henry Hills, there's no mention of King or anything like that. And the one on the left clearly was printed after the Restoration. And so the King's motto, God and my right, in French, and the unicorn and lion, which are the symbols of the British monarchy, are on there. So a very topsy-turvy time reflected in the Bibles. Okay. Now, I mentioned there were only the three printers. Okay, so pretty close to a monopoly. And one of the consequences of that monopoly was they weren't always very careful because they figured people would buy the Bibles anyway. And so in particular, in the early 18th century, one of the printers, the Oxford printer, was John Baskett. And later on, his son Mark Baskett was the printer. And John Baskett was notorious for his errors. Very sloppy, didn't proofread. And so people called his Bibles basketfuls of error. And this top Bible here on the right, which we have flat, is the 1717 John Baskett Bible. It's one volume of it. We didn't bother putting both volumes out. It's called the Vinegar Bible. Okay. Not because it smells like vinegar or anything else, but because in Luke, where there's the parable of the vineyard, okay, and they have the little title at the top for what's in that chapter, sloppily the printer put the parable of the vinegar instead of the vineyard. So we did copy that and blow it up a little, but it's hard to see up there. Baskett, however, may not have proofread, but he was very big on having images to attract people. And so both the 1717 Bible and the 1732 edition by Baskett that we have down here have very elaborate images, page after page, of these engravings. Okay. And then finally, I want to finish up and segue over to America with this Bible, printed in 1765 by Mark Baskett, John's son. Okay. And it was a family Bible. You see, people would write family information in it. In this case, it records the birth of one Martha Dandridge, who actually had been born 30-some years earlier, so they're filling in information later. But anyway, Martha Dandridge grew up to be, does anyone know? Martha Washington. And so we will move to America in Special Collections. Okay. The Crown copyright extended to America, and so there were in colonial America no English language Bibles printed. Okay. The first Bible printed, in fact, was in the Natick Indian language in 1663. It was printed in Cambridge, Massachusetts. That translation was made by a Puritan minister, John Eliot, okay, who was known as the Apostle to the Indians. He established some of the praying Indian towns in Massachusetts and so on. And so we do have a leaf from that right up here. Okay. The other complete Bibles that were printed were in German. Okay. Those being printed by father and son printers, Christoph and Christoph Sauer, in Germantown, Pennsylvania. The first in 1743. We have the third edition from 1776, and that's the Bible you see here in the middle of the case. Okay. This is known, by the way, as the Gunwad Bible. Okay, it was printed in 1776. Of course, the American Revolutionary War had started the year before. Now, the Sowers printed 3,000 copies of, well, they were trying to print 3,000 copies of this Bible in 1776. And so they had printed the various pages, you know, had them stacked up ready to sew together and bind together in 1777. It took a while to do the Bible. When war came to Germantown, and the story is that soldiers at the Battle of Germantown did take the pages that were stacked up and use it as gun wad for their rifles, for their muskets, rather. And so most of the edition was destroyed. They only had enough left to put together a handful of complete Bibles. And so this is actually one of the scarcest Bibles around. So that's the Gunwad Bible.
Are the Gunwad Bibles Catholic classics?
They're Lutheran, I think. Yeah, Martin Luther's. Yeah, they're Lutheran Bibles. And we also just wanted to show you this. On to the left of the Gunwad Bible is another hybrid. It's various books put together. And so there are several religious books in here that were printed in Germany. But there also is a Psalter printed by Christoph Sauer in 1759 in Germantown. And they're bound together, again, in a kind of Harry Potter-ish binding. Okay. And so we'll move up here to the first English language Bible printed in America. And that's this little one in the middle of the top shelf, the Aitken Bible. This is the only Bible, by the way, in the entire exhibit that does not belong to Swem Library. This does belong to Bruton Parish. And they did allow us to use it for the exhibit. It normally is housed at SWEM, by the way. We do house Bruton Parish's archives here. But anyway, this is also, the Aitken Bible is also the only Bible endorsed by Congress. Robert Aitken of Philadelphia was the printer for Congress, and he did approach Congress and ask them to endorse his Bible. They didn't jump right into it. They had a couple of ministers check it out, and they said, yes, it's a good Bible. Carefully done. It's not like those basketfuls of error. And so Congress gave its blessing to the Bible, to the Aitken Bible. It never made the money that Robert Aitken had hoped for. In fact, he lost money on it. But that's the Aitken Bible printed in 1782. And then if we move down here to the bottom left, this is the first of several volumes of the Bible printed in 1791 by Isaiah Thomas. Isaiah Thomas is a very important person for anyone studying American history, early American history, early American literature. He was a Boston printer, fled 3 days before the Battle of Lexington in 1775. He was on the Patriot side. So he fled 3 days before the Battle of Lexington, set up a new print shop in Worcester, Massachusetts, and that's where this was printed, in Worcester in 1791. But he had decided, new nation, you know, we need to be proud of our history, we need to be proud of our literary history, and so he went about and collected everything he could that had been published in America. Okay. Books, newspapers, anything he could get his hands on, he tried to collect. And his collection became the basis for the American Antiquarian Society, which he founded. And if you do end up, over the next 4 years, using the digital collections that are called Early American Imprints, the basis for that is the American Antiquarian Society's collections, okay, started by Isaiah Thomas. Okay. But in any case, 1791, hadn't yet founded the American Antiquarian Society. Was starting to collect stuff, but very proud of the new nation. So he commissioned the leading American artist to create illustrations for his Bible. There are 50 illustrations by American artists. He also gave people, he was trying to maximize sales. And so he gave buyers options. So you could buy a big folio edition like this, or you could buy a smaller quarto edition. You could buy with or without the illustrations. which obviously all of that affected the price. Ours is the folio with illustrations, so it's the deluxe edition. We could hope that he had done a better job on the bindings, which have fallen apart, which is why we could so handily move the title page over to the left so you could see both that and an illustration, because the title page is totally out of the binding. Yes?
For that Bible there, I think it says with the Apocrypha.
Very rarely, actually. Most of the Bibles to this point do have the Apocrypha, even when they would seem to be very Protestant Bibles. Okay, yes?
So in 1776, the first early American Bibles before that, you mentioned the people who came on the Mayflower, I believe, and how that was the Bible they took. What percentage of American families had a Bible in their house at this point?
A fair number. If they were going to have any book, it would be a Bible. More so, more in New England than in the South, because the literacy rate was much, much higher. But even families that really didn't seem able to read much would often have a Bible. So that's 1791, Isaiah Thomas. Thomas and another printer named Matthew Carey, in the next decade, created another innovation in printed Bibles. The other guy was a Catholic printer in Philadelphia named Matthew Carey. And he did print the earliest Catholic Bible in America, which we don't have a copy of. We do have this Bible here was printed by him on the bottom right, the Adam Empey Bible. And the innovation that they came up with, and you saw out there Martha Dandridge's family record and so on, people would just put those on a blank page in the book. They actually created family records, family register pages, specifically for people to write the family births, marriages, deaths, and so on. And so that was Isaiah Thomas and Matthew Carey. We have a couple of them open here. The top right is the family Bible of James Monroe, who is an alumnus of William and Mary, of course, and U.S. president. And that does record in James Monroe's own handwriting the marriage of his daughter. Okay. The one down here on the bottom right, the Adam Empey Bible. Empey was a New Yorker by birth from Schenectady, New York. He was a minister. Had gone down to North Carolina, Wilmington, North Carolina, as a minister, married the daughter of a local wealthy family, and they gave him slaves as a wedding present. He was opposed to slavery, and so he freed the family slaves. He later came to Bruton Parish and William and Mary. He was president of William and Mary from 1826 to 1827 to 1836. But he was opposed to slavery, as I said. And this was the time of Nat Turner's slave rebellion. Virginia kind of teetered after Turner's slave rebellion in 1831. Virginia came very close to voting to end slavery in Virginia. But once they voted to keep it, they voted to keep it in a very big way. And so, actually, Adam Empey got run out of town, basically. And the college hired in his place as president Thomas Dew, who was one of the great defenders of slavery. He was kind of the intellectual father of the defense of slavery. But anyway, this Empey Bible records some of Adam Empey's own family record, as well as marriages he performed at the University of William and Mary. And they often did call it, by the way, in the mid-1800s, the University of William and Mary. Okay. Next on our scheme here, in the middle, still with ties to the American Revolution, is this 1808 Bible. It's actually a multi-volume set. And this particular Bible was translated from the Greek by Charles Thompson, who'd been secretary to the Continental Congress. He spent 20 years translating. Clearly, he was independently wealthy to be able to afford that. But I particularly want to point it out, not only because it was the first Bible in American English, as opposed to British English. It also was printed by a female, Jane Aitken, Robert Aitken of Aitken Bible. His daughter, Jane, was also a printer, and so she printed that. Okay, and up here we have an 1806. It's not a Bible exactly. It's Bible stories. Translated into the Delaware Indian language by a Moravian missionary. And so it's English and Delaware Indian on opposite pages. Okay. And then finally over here on the middle right is the Book of Mormon, first edition, from 1830. Normally, by the way, we do let people read our Book of Mormon, and we are apparently the only institution in the country that does. It has been digitized and put online, and so most institutions tell people to go read it online. But word has kind of gotten out that we do let people normally read it. And so we do get, we have in the past few summers had Mormon families come from across the country to come look at the Bible, and they'll have, you know, family photo taken holding the Bible, holding the Book of Mormon, and the same with Mormon missionaries. Will come in big groups to be able to look at that. So we will move on to the first of the flat cases. Okay. And this is our Thomas Jefferson case. Of course, the most famous of our college alumni. And his religious views were always controversial. Okay. They were controversial in his lifetime, and they've been controversial since. And so we have here several manuscripts relating to him and his views of the Bible. And the first is this letter in front. And it was written to him right at the height of the presidential election campaign of 1800, where he was running against Aaron Burr of New York. And one of Jefferson's New York supporters wrote to him, said, "Well, your religious views have become a political issue, and I don't believe the things people are saying about you," which, you know, tended towards the "he's godless," et cetera, et cetera. So I don't believe those things. So if you would just answer two questions, then, you know, I'm sure we can clear this all up. And so he said, "So what do you think about all of mankind descending from two people?" And then the other, I think, was about Jonah and the whale. Let's see. Yeah. Whether there was a deluge, that's what it was. Was there the flood that Noah reacted to? So he writes that. We actually do have a letter soon after that, that Jefferson's writing to a friend, and he's saying he's so tired of people questioning his religious beliefs. So we don't know that he responded to this particular supporter. But then we have up here on the left of the case, while he was president, he wrote to a friend of his, Dr. Benjamin Rush, that he was creating a syllabus, an outline, for comparing Jesus' views to those of other great thinkers. Okay. And then we do have where, and he says, you know, and I want other people to do it. He says, you know, I'm president, I don't have time to do that. But I want other people to actually do the study. But I'm creating an outline for it. And so we do actually have the syllabus where he outlines that. And it's comparing Jesus's beliefs to those of Cicero and Seneca. Okay. One of the other activities that Jefferson engaged in religiously was to cut up the Bible. He took a polyglot Bible, so one of the multilingual Bibles, and cut out everything he considered superstitious from the New Testament and just left in what he thought was true. That was not printed in his lifetime. Okay, he did make copies for some friends and family members, and the National Museum ended up with a copy in 1895, and Congress ordered it published by the Government Printing Office in 1904. And so we do have a couple of copies of that here in this case. Oddly, for 50 years, Congress gave every new member of Congress a copy of the Jefferson Bible. I don't know. It seemed like a good idea. And then here we have our final case in the exhibit, and that's about the spread of the printed Bible into other languages. There was a Bible society founded in Britain in 1804. There started to be American state chapters of Bible societies a few years later. The Virginia Bible Society was founded in 1813, and then the American Bible Society several years later. And so we do have several annual reports from the Virginia Bible Society. John Millington of Millington Hall fame, who was a chemistry professor here, was the president of the Williamsburg chapter. And they were very busy distributing Bibles to the poor and raising money for giving Bibles away. Okay. The other thing that these Bible societies sponsored was translations into languages that the Bible had not previously been translated into. And so we have some of those here. That work continues to the present day. So actually we do have several that are from the mid-1800s. There's a translation here into Mohawk from, I think, 1836. Over here on the right is into Tamil, which is a language of South Asia. On the right, Syriac, 1905, and then Chinese, 1931, okay, and Russian, 1948, which was a Cold War support Christians in the Soviet Union type deal. Okay, I also want to point out this tiny little Bible on display. In the text, it's a complete Bible. The text is incredibly small. That's a Bible that was taken by a doctor from Ohio to California during the California Gold Rush. He went in 1851. We have his diary here in Special Collections. He was miserable the whole time. He was sick most of the time. He didn't find any gold. Whined and wailed. He was not the least bit stoic in his diary. But religion was his comfort, and this little Bible and was what he'd taken with him. And that was true for a lot of the people. So remember, when you're taking all your possessions on a wagon, miniature is good. And so there were miniature Bibles that were taken. The last Bible I want to point out to you is with the Gunwad Bible, probably the most rare of the Bibles that we have. It's actually just a New Testament, part of a New Testament. This is from 1836, and it is a pre-Braille New Testament for the blind, published in Massachusetts. And so it is, it's raised letter, but it's letters, it's not the dots that's used by the Braille system. It's a stack of pages. And so we just took the title page and the first page of the Gospel of Matthew for that. So the spread of the printed word is the end of our Bible exhibit. So I hope you've enjoyed it. Hope you've learned something. And you're welcome.